Welcome to this program, recorded in Chicago at the Inflation and Gold Seminar, sponsored by U.S. Paper Exchange Tempor Corporation, May 24th through the 26th, 1980. Our topic is the philosophic basis of capitalism. Our speaker is Leonard Peikoff, professor of philosophy. Now to our program.
Thank you very much, James. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. All of you here this morning are suffering and indirectly or directly are counting on capitalism as the only hope of relief. You're suffering in one form or another from Washington, from government strangulation of the economy, from a torrent of government-caused evils which keep getting worse year after year, such as an ominous inflation and now the signs of a recession, and an energy crisis, and burgeoning taxation, and burgeoning bureaucrats stifling business, and burgeoning Ralph Nader-type pressure groups demanding still more regulation. In other words, from controls which are now out of control. As investors, you hope to minimize your pain by acting on your own initiative. The element of risk-taking, of earning a reward by the exercise of your judgment, in other words, the element that remains still of capitalism. If you're seeking a long-term strategy and solution, not just a quick fix or a quick kill, what you have to ask is how long will this remaining element remain in the United States or in the world? I want to start by defining terms. The American system today, and this is true not only of the United States, but of the whole Western world, our system today is not capitalism. It can most neutrally be described as a mixed economy. A mixed economy is a mixture, a compromise of two opposite elements: individual freedom and government controls. It's an economy ruled by free market decision and by bureaucratic decree. It's part capitalism, part socialism or statism. Now, by its very nature, this is a contradiction. It is a contradictory system, and therefore it's unstable. It is transitory. It's a transition stage, not a permanent state of affairs. As all history shows, controls breed controls. The statist element in the mixture does not stand still. It grows and grows until, if it's not thrown off, if our direction is not reversed once and for all, if pure capitalism is not instituted, then the only outcome in the end is full statism, full dictatorship. And you can see this process, unfortunately, happening all around you now, at home and abroad. When I say capitalism, therefore, I do not mean today's mixed economy. I mean what used to be called laissez-faire capitalism. And the simple definition is the separation of state and economics. The separation of state and economics. It means no government interference in the economy. No special favors of any kind to any group, whether business, labor, farmers, consumers, tea tasters, or any other group. I mean a system based on individual rights. And by rights, I have a very specific meaning. Man's right to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness. And by property, I do not mean the right to a handout, but the property you can earn by your own effort and trade. Under capitalism, these rights, the ones I specifically mention, are absolutes which the government cannot infringe or revoke. The founding fathers of this country said that they were natural, these rights, and unalienable. The sole function of government is the protection of these rights from violation by force or fraud, which means, in essence, the protection of individuals from brutality. Under capitalism, the government leaves each individual free to pursue his own life and decide on his own actions. so long, of course, as he respects the equal right of others to the same freedom. Now, this, in essence, is the original American system as spelled out in the Constitution in the Declaration of Independence. Capitalism is the best social system devised in all man's history. You only have to look to the phenomenal rise in living standards in the 19th century, which was the closest to capitalism that the Western world ever came. Not only the rise in prosperity and abundance, but also in life expectancy, in peace, in human confidence, in human happiness. As against that, you need merely consider the state of the world today, which I don't have to detail for you, from the crisis-ridden mixed economies of the West, with living standards steadily falling and discontent steadily spreading, right on to the full socialist, full statist countries, as in the communist and so-called third worlds, where conditions range from mass starvation to mass slaughter, and where men risk their lives to escape to something better, anything, fleeing before a hail of bullets at the Berlin Wall, or recently in fragile craft to reach the Mecca of Key West from Cuba by the tens of thousands. Now, although I would like to, I'm not here today to convert you to capitalism. Most of you, I've been given to understand, are at least more or less sympathetic to the original American system of government. And some of you I know personally, and I know that you're passionate defenders and champions of capitalism. In any event, today I am going to assume that I am not addressing a socialist audience. If I'm wrong, you have an extended question period to get back at me. I'm going to assume in a general way you're pro-capitalist and raise a different question. What happened to the original American system? What did it depend on? Why did we lose it? Why did capitalism vanish to the extent that it already has? It's not an issue of practicality. Capitalism is the only practical social system. That's been demonstrated time and again. It's the only system that makes wealth and prosperity possible. This is known, it's been known and proved since the days at least of the classical economists, and it's repeated daily, regularly by the conservatives today. But although it's known, it has changed nothing. We have the most practical system, or we once did, capitalism. Everyone, including its enemies, know that point full well, and yet the whole world is galloping away from it and is against it. Now, if you see a spectacle like that, you have to conclude that whoever or whatever it is that moves the world, they don't care about practicality, obviously. To them, to the leaders of the world, there's something above practicality, something above wealth, something above individual freedom. Then why? What is the explanation of the world's trend? Well, some pessimists say that the trouble is the nature of most people. They say people are too stupid to know what's good for them. That people are really larcenous. They really want something for nothing. They're really parasites at heart, that everyone is born lusting after government handouts. Now, I reject this view. I regard it as false of any country, but absurdly false as applied to the United States. And here I'm not being chauvinistic, since I was not born in the United States. I'm an American by choice, so if I praise this country, it's not on chauvinistic ground. The people in this country are the best in the world and the best in all history. Most of them are pro-capitalist, much more so than their leaders, intellectual or political. The people are generally fed up with the welfare state and the trend of the past decades. When the intellectuals a few years ago came out for George McGovern at a ratio of 99 out of 100, the people gave a landslide to Nixon. When the college professors rushed out to embrace and egg on the thugs on the college campuses in the 60s, it was the workers, the construction unions and the longshoremen who demonstrated. They marched into Wall Street, not to overthrow business, but to save America from the leftist students. When the politicians in California were taxing the state to death, the result was Proposition 13, which, as you know, spread like wildfire. Now, I could multiply these examples without end. The problem in the United States is not the people. It's that the people have no real influence over the course of the nation. Well, here's another explanation that's commonly offered. It's been said, the trouble is the politicians. The politicians are the villains. Now, I don't want to debate that. Obviously, many of them are villains. But that is not a sufficient answer, because you have another question. Why are so many of them so bad? It wasn't always so, and is not inherent in politics. There once was a time when the politicians of this country were the men we call the founding fathers. They were politicians. What made the difference? It's the same species today. It can't be a matter that our genes have deteriorated that much in 200 years. Today, these people run for office, the candidates find the system, the mixed economy system, already there. It's set, it's in place, it's a fact of nature, as far as they see, and they merely adapt to it. The latest crisis erupts, the next pressure group screams, the politicians respond automatically with some new controls or new favors. Now, these people didn't cause the country's troubles, not at root. They are merely coasting along, riding on what we already have. So the question is, again, why do we have it? How did the mixed economy system get here? Why did capitalism perish? The answer is not, to give you one last wrong answer, the answer is not any concrete event or evil, such as, I'll give you a whole litany, the Depression of 29, or the inflation, or the energy crisis, or all the rest of them. All of this is a rationalization. None of these evils come from capitalism, but from government controls. And the same is true of all the other evils commonly ascribed to capitalism, like coercive monopolies and unemployment and widows and orphans begging in the streets and so on. Economists have demonstrated over and over that none of this comes from capitalism, but from government interference in the economy. And observe in this connection that the opponents of capitalism who raise these kind of objections change them repeatedly. You refute one in spades, they promptly forget it and dredge up another. And you can see that process on a smaller scale in connection with nuclear power, for instance, where they put forth six arguments. The arguments are smashed by the defenders of nuclear power and promptly forgotten by the opponents, who come up with a whole bunch of new ones. You saw the same thing in the rioting students in the 60s, who would pick some issue allegedly proving that Columbia University exploited them, and the instant the university capitulated, they lost all interest in that issue, and they started on the next one. Now, obviously, this kind of attack is motivated at root by a well of hatred, which is not explained by the specific issues and arguments that its advocates offer. The basic hatred is for the system as such, for capitalism. So we still have to ask why. Why such hatred? And the real answer lies in the fact that a political system is not a primary. A political system is not a primary. Using primary there in a philosophic sense, not in the sense of an electoral process. It's not a beginning. Politics, any kind of politics, is the end result of a whole system of thought, of a system of philosophy. Philosophy is a science with many branches. And I want to hear, for those of you unfamiliar with it, mention the three most important branches. Not to be too academic about it, but we need some terminology to go on. Ethics is one crucial branch. That studies good and evil, right and wrong, how man should live. Metaphysics, another branch, studies the nature of the universe, the nature of reality, what is real. And finally, epistemology, not as bad as the word sounds, epistemology, which studies knowledge. How do we know? What is the proper method of using our minds to come to reliable conclusions? Now, these three subjects, essentially, ethics, metaphysics, epistemology. You can think of it as values, the nature of reality, the nature of knowledge. They're the base of any philosophy, these three subjects, and politics rests on them. It's the last step and consequence. Every society throughout history, whether it knows this or not, has some kind of views on these basic issues. And that's what leads it to its particular politics. Today, the basic philosophy of the West, I'm speaking of its intellectual leadership, is dead set against capitalism on all the crucial issues, all the ones that come before politics and rule politics. Ideas, and I mean here basic philosophic ideas, are what determines history. If a nation's basic ideas in the minds of its leaders are against freedom, then freedom will have to give way, even if the public is unhappy about the trend. Unhappiness, even mass unhappiness, does not change history. People were unhappy in the Middle Ages. As another example, they were ragged, they were hungry, they were enslaved to the feudal system, but the system lasted for centuries despite mass discontent. Why? Because its founding ideas, the philosophy of the Middle Ages, was not challenged. Only when that took place, when those ideas were challenged, which didn't take place till the 13th century, only then did a historical change take place and the Middle Ages began to come to an end. Until then, there were blind uprisings of discontented people all the time. You can think of those uprisings as like the Proposition 13 of the Middle Ages, where people just couldn't stand it anymore, but they were defeated time after time by the establishment, as they're working to defeat the movement in California today. If capitalism is to be saved, an unphilosophical uprising is not enough. We have to discover capitalism's philosophic base and then defend it. Now that brings me to the essence of the subject this morning, the philosophic basis of capitalism. The ideas at the root of capitalism are the opposite of all of today's prevalent ideas, which is why capitalism is perishing. They're the opposite of everything taught in today's colleges. They're the opposite of all the bromides you read in the papers or hear at cocktail parties or see in the movies. Now this is a complex subject, philosophic basis of capitalism, but I've selected three main issues, one from each of the big three branches of philosophy, to give you at least an indication of what kind of things are involved in defending capitalism. And let me give you an agenda in advance with one word, which I will then proceed to elaborate. Selfishness, reality, reason. That corresponding to the three main branches, ethics, metaphysics, epistemology. Those three words contain the essence of the issue, but it would be nice to give a little elaboration. That's perhaps too terse. Let's look at point one. Selfishness. Selfishness. F-I-S-H. From branch of philosophy of ethics. Capitalism rests on a certain type of ethics, what Ayn Rand calls the virtue of selfishness. Now this is fairly obvious to the enemies and friends alike of capitalism, even if from no other thing than the fact that capitalism rests on the profit motive, which means it rests on men trying to improve their own conditions, to produce wealth, to make money, to achieve their own welfare, to enjoy their own life. The system counts on men who want to pursue values and achieve personal happiness. In other words, in this basic way, it counts on selfishness. If everyone were like the medieval saints, if what they wanted was to go out in the desert and mortify the flesh, eat rotten fruit, drink only water in which laundry had been washed, sleep with rocks for their pillows, abstain from pleasure, march through the streets flagellating themselves, then there would be no production, no wealth, no profit motive, no capitalism, and no life on earth for very long either. Selfishness, according to objectivism, means each man is an end in himself, not a means to the ends of others. And therefore, men have to deal with one another by trade, trading value for value by mutual consent to mutual advantage, as and when both sides agree to trade. Selfishness means, and I'm giving the objective as you, no sacrifice in human relations, no sacrifice, no victims. Now, some people give you the choice of cutting your throat for others, which they call self-sacrifice, or cutting other people's throat for yourself, which they call selfishness. Now, the objective is you should be distinguished from both of these. We are opposed to throat cutting as such, and we do not haggle about victims. Selfishness means that each individual exists as an independent, self-supporting entity. He recognizes the rights of others, and he expects them to recognize his. Now, this is the code of ethics that capitalism actually counts on and institutionalizes. Now, what would the opposite be? The ethics of selflessness. That would be the idea that you should be unselfish, that morality or virtue consists of serving something outside and above yourself, which one group says is God and the other group says is the state. It's the idea that your highest virtue is self-sacrifice. Now let's be clear here what we're talking about. Self-sacrifice is not the same as helping others. That all depends. You can be completely selfish and still help a man if he's of value to you and you help him with a sum that you can afford. For instance, a friend of yours. If in such a case it's still an act to support your value, your friend, your happiness. That is still selfish, although the beneficiary directly of your action is another person. When would it be self-sacrifice? When the recipient is nothing whatever to you personally, and your action in helping him causes a disaster to the things you personally selfishly value. For instance, if you help a stranger with limited funds and the result is you let your own child starve, and you do it on the grounds, well, others are above me, who am I, my destiny is self-sacrifice. That would be self-sacrifice. Now, if that kind of ethics is virtue, then capitalism is evil. You cannot escape from that conclusion. Capitalism doesn't appeal to men's desire to suffer and serve and renounce, but rather to enjoy life. It doesn't appeal to our desire to abnegate ourselves, but to succeed. Not to give away wealth, but to create property and keep it. Not to sacrifice, but to fulfill ourselves. I said that capitalism is a system of individual rights, and rights are a selfish concept, a selfish concept. Your rights are rights to what? To your life, your liberty, your property, the pursuit of your happiness. If your basic moral obligation is sacrificial service to others, however, then you are not an end in yourself, but a means to the ends of others or society. And then you can have no inalienable rights. Instead, all you can have is duties. And in the end, society can do with you what it wants. You are their property. You belong to others by that code. And they can tell you how and when they expect you to serve them. And that means there are no rights, no freedom. You exist and function by permission of the state. As, for instance, under communism or under fascism. Both of which preach versions of the ethics of self-sacrifice. Both of which attack selfishness for all they're worth. One side demanding self-sacrifice for the proletariat, the other for the master race. Paradoxically enough, it's the dictators of the world who know the moral issues at stake. Hitler and Stalin knew. Here is a quotation from Adolf Hitler. Quote, "This self-sacrificing will to give one's personal labor and if necessary, one's own life for others is most strongly developed in the Aryan. The Aryan is not greatest in his mental qualities as such, but in the extent of his willingness to put all his abilities in the service of the community. In him, the instinct of self-preservation has reached the noblest form, since he willingly subordinates his own ego to the life of the community, and if the hour demands, even sacrifices it." Unquote. That's from Mein Kampf. And Hitler made sure, when in power, to enforce this code. If anyone objected to his decrees and said he was suffering as a result and tried to assert himself, Hitler was quick to answer, "Who are you to question? Your duty is not to seek happiness, but to sacrifice for the whole of whom I'm the leader." Now, I regret to say, I hope it's not applicable to people here today, that many businessmen do not understand the moral issues involved as well as Hitler and Stalin did. Many businessmen are eager to try to justify freedom and capitalism in terms of self-sacrifice. They're eager to appease their critics. They say that in huge full-page ads that they're really unselfish in running their firms, they're really selfless, that their only goal is to help widows and orphans. Now, this kind of claim fails blatantly. For one thing, it's supposed to help the image of big business, and people do not believe it. For very good reason, because they know that business by its nature is production, and often fighting against competition to grow and prosper. It's the opposite of self-sacrifice. It doesn't take too much imagination to know what would happen to a consistently self-sacrificial businessman. In his first labor negotiations, he would have to be concerned only with the needs of the workers. He couldn't be concerned with their ability. Will they be able to deliver the work that he needs? Because that's his own selfish concern. He can't be concerned with wage levels. He's quite happy to sacrifice to unable workers because they need it. He's happy to sell to his customers under the costs of his product because, after all, he lives to serve his customers and he's eager to sacrifice himself. If he does, by these policies, have any money left over at the end of the fiscal period, he doesn't bother with such a thing as capital accumulation, which is the profit motive and selfish. He rushes to distribute it among the hungry mouths of the third world so that he can say he's free of the vicious profit motive. Now, you see, this kind of mentality would be out of business in a flash. He would be cannibalized out of existence. The appeasing businessman thinks that he's improving his image by saying how unselfish he is. All he's doing is making business come across as a guilty hypocrite. He's encouraging the Ralph Nader types to make ever more brash demands because he takes these full-page ads and he says, in effect, "All my money is yours, dear people. I'm going to give it away soon. I only live for you. Please be patient. It's all coming to you." And of course, what the Ralph Nader types stand up and say, "We want more now. If it belongs to the people, let's have it." And that is exactly, in a nutshell, the spectacle in the world before you today. You see big business with all its vast resources being eaten alive. Why? Because they feel guilty. Guilty of the ethics that is inherent in capitalism. Capitalism rests on the ethics of selfishness. It can't survive, and it isn't surviving under the ethics of self-sacrifice. That's point one on the philosophic basis of capitalism. Point two, this is now take us into metaphysics, reality. Now, we can approach this point via another kind of charge that's leveled against capitalism, namely that it's too materialistic. And therefore, you hear it's low, vulgar, crude. It's not concerned with the so-called higher things of life, but is focused on machinery, money, technology. Its opponents call it gadgets, plumbing, anything that they can think to stress. It's a system mired in the physical. Now, I might point out that the people who say this ignore the fact that it takes enormous intelligence and ingenuity. It takes the exercise of man's mind to create material wealth. The Industrial Revolution, which is the source of the wealth in the modern world, was a triumph of thought, of knowledge, the thought of the scientists who discovered the basic laws of nature, of the inventors who learned to apply this knowledge to the improvement of man's life, of the industrialists who discovered how to organize and run large-scale commercial undertakings to mass-produce the inventions of the laboratory. In this regard, the claim that wealth is, quote, purely materialistic is false. It rests on a whole chain of knowledge. Nevertheless, this much is true. Capitalism is a secular system. I mean, it's concerned with this world, this physical world, not some other dimension. capitalism does not offer men heavenly bliss, but earthly rewards and earthly happiness. And this earth is definitely material. It's physical. What is the viewpoint, the metaphysics, of those who curse matter and machinery? Well, historically, it goes back to Plato in ancient Greece and to early Christianity, for instance, St. Augustine. This kind of thinker says, there's another world. There's two realities. There's this low physical world we live in now, and there's another higher non-material dimension, which is entirely different from this earth, and that dimension, they say, is true reality and man's true destiny. This world, they say, is only, in effect, approximately real, half real. It's temporary, and we should be above it and resist the temptation to start enjoying it. Our goal should be to disdain and escape it rather than exploit and enjoy it. Augustine, one of the most consistent in this regard, said that even science is materialistic. It's far too physical. Well, they give it all kinds of names. Plato called it the world of forms. Christianity called it God. The Orientals often call it Nirvana. Many college students today, holding exactly the same basic ideas, say that the other reality is ineffable, can't be described, but it's revealed to them in an LSD trance, which they often say also reveals the evil of nuclear power and of the whole Industrial Revolution. Now, it doesn't make any difference what you call it. What they all have in common is there's some kind of supernatural dimension, which is the opposite of everything we perceive by our senses, which is allegedly superior to this world. And the conclusion, this world is imperfect, it's low, it's unreal, it's unimportant, and therefore concern for this world is low, and capitalism therefore is unworthy. Now, capitalism, by contrast, rests on an opposite view of reality. It rests on the metaphysics of one reality, this one. That was, of course, the basic philosophy of Aristotle, who is the major philosopher of capitalism. Capitalism rejects the idea of a supernatural dimension contradicting this world. It's based on the acceptance of this world, the world revealed by our five senses, on the acceptance of this earth as final, as absolute, as reality, and therefore as the proper and exclusive object of men's thought and concern. According to capitalism, you should exploit the earth to the fullest, and remake it to improve the material conditions of human life, and use your brains to invent physical improvements and gadgets and plumbing and automobiles and bigger automobiles and color TV and build and grow and progress, because this is it. This life, life is thought and action. It's getting an idea and then giving it physical form on earth. And that's why Ayn Rand says that the heroes among men are not the fortune tellers, but the fortune makers. Not the people who flee from this world, or the hippies who live out of garbage cans as a matter of principle, but the industrialist who masters the material world and creates abundance. Now, historically, capitalism developed only with the rise of a this-worldly attitude. Only when the belief in the supernatural began to fade in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries. It took a long time to fade. It was impossible even to conceive of capitalism so long as the West was ruled by belief in another dimension. Now, some people think that America was founded on a supernaturalist or Christian philosophy. This is not true. It's not true historically or philosophically. The founding fathers, comparatively speaking, were non-religious men. They were deists, which means, compared to the Puritans who preceded them, they were virtually unbelievers. God was mainly an issue of lip service to them. On their view of deism, God started the universe off and then retired, gave up any further active function, and simply watched, so he was no longer a factor in life thereafter, and they did not accordingly take religion seriously. They stressed nature and its laws, not God. And the preachers at the time, if you read the revolutionary literature, complained at the bad state religion was in when this country was founded. One of them said he doesn't know what to do. Religion is, quote, being laughed out of existence. And that was true. It was true of the whole Enlightenment era in which the United States was founded. If you want to study the chances of capitalism in a really religious country, where they do take supernaturalism seriously still today, you don't have to look any further than Iran. The Ayatollah Khomeini is a true representative of supernaturalism, not just of Islam, because in principle, he holds the same creed and approach as the Middle Ages did in the West, the same anti-pleasure, anti-music, anti-freedom, anti-this life, and you see what chance rights, money-making, or capitalism have in that kind of atmosphere. Capitalism rests on selfishness, that's its ethical base, and in metaphysics, on a certain view of reality, that there's only one reality, this one. And that brings us finally to point three, reason. From epistemology. Now the basic question of epistemology is, how does man know? How can we acquire reliable knowledge? And you really have only two basic choices in answer, reason or non-reason, reason or anti-reason. And I think you can see that your answer will be closely linked with your metaphysics. If you believe in a supernatural dimension, for instance, you'll immediately be asked, how do you know that it exists? And you'll have to answer with something like, oh, by faith, by revelation, by some mystical means. So you end up coming out for some kind of mysticism. On the other hand, if this world, this physical world, is your focus and your primary, then you're asked, how do you know that? And you say, I use my senses. I observe facts. I go by logic. In other words, you're going by reason. And this is why the two basic philosophers in all history are Plato and Aristotle, and they clashed on all fundamentals in metaphysics. Plato was the supernaturalist, Aristotle the advocate of this world. In epistemology, Plato was the father of mysticism, Aristotle the father of logic and science. Now on this issue too, capitalism is repeatedly attacked on philosophic grounds as being too rational. You will hear it probably in the form that capitalism is a cold, unfeeling system, that businessmen or capitalists are interested only in facts, figures, efficiency, balance sheets. They don't run their concerns according to some kind of higher mystic feelings or intuitions from the beyond, but in accordance with disciplined rationality, with reason. Now, in essence, this charge is true. Not of every businessman, of course, I wish it were, but of the successful ones. And to, I mean now, the extent that they succeed by their own effort and not by government favors, pull, or contracts. Just as capitalism rests on this reality, so it rests on the power of human reason. Capitalism, I said, is the greatest system of production. Production for man is primarily an act of reason, of the mind, of intelligence. Wealth is not created by manual labor. This is contrary to the Marxist viewpoint. Who brought more wealth into the world? Legions of unskilled workers or Thomas Edison and Henry Ford? There's plenty of manual labor in the so-called underdeveloped world, but they're starving. What they lack is not muscles, but men like Edison and Ford, and what made them possible. Capitalism is the system of greatest wealth because it's the only system that exalts science, ingenuity, thought, the mind. It's the only system that leaves men free to think. This is the actual basis of individual rights. What do rights amount to? They're the right to act. How? Not as someone orders you to, but on your judgment. Your best conclusions, your own mind. Men's mind, says capitalism, is the means of wealth, actually our whole means of survival. And therefore the mind must be respected. It must be left free to function. You must never try to force the mind of another. If you disagree with others, then you have to try to change their mind by rational persuasion, or don't deal with them. But never try to force another. Of course, if he acts criminally, if he resorts to force, you can use force perfectly properly as retaliation. But never initiate force against an innocent man. And this prohibition against initiating physical force is the essence of the issue of rights. The basis is the supremacy of reason, and therefore the rejection of brutality as a means of dealing with others. The idea behind capitalism is men must live as rational beings, solving their disputes by peaceful means. That is the conviction that underlies the advocacy of inalienable rights. And this is the basic reason why capitalism didn't develop sooner in history. It could develop only after the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment. What were they enlightened about in the Enlightenment? The power of reason. In other words, it could develop only after a pro-reason philosophy was firmly established in the West. Now, what other kind of philosophy is there? What's the alternative to reason? Some form of unreason, of what's called mysticism. Mysticism is the belief that you can acquire knowledge by some non-sensory, non-rational means, such as faith, or revelation, or LSD, or arbitrary feeling, or you name it. It says there's something which transcends man's senses and mind. Now, mystics are not too clear about what their alternative to reason is. Many of them say, either you know what it is, or you don't, my special faculty. If you do, no explanation is necessary. If you don't, none is possible, so either way, I don't explain. Now, if this philosophy can be accepted, then capitalism is invalid, contemptible, impossible. Because in such a case, we would need a system built not on the requirements of reason, but on revelation, trances, or whatever. Now, you might ask, well, what kind of system would that be? And if you want a clue to it, observe simply that every mystic in the history of philosophy, everyone who attacked reason in some major way, ended up as an advocate of statism. This is true from Plato and Augustine to Hegel, Hitler, and right on to the New Left. If reason is rejected, if thought is out, then persuasion and peaceful dealings among men is also out. And then force, brute force, is what's in. And in which case, someone has to order men what to do and enforce it by the power of a gun. So in the long run, your choice is either reason and capitalism or unreason and dictatorship. If you ask the advocates of statism why they believe in their system, how they defend it, ultimately, after volumes and volumes of cover-up, you'll hear a single answer. You have to work to press the person to come out with this, but finally you'll get it. He'll say, I can't prove it, but I feel it. And that's what counts. My feelings, not reason or logic, is the test of truth. This is what Plato, for instance, the father of communism, said. He had feelings, he claimed, about another world. And despite all the propaganda, this is what Marx and Engels said, because communism, among many other points, is based on the dialectic process, which is a series of contradictions which wipe out logic. This is what Hitler said when he appealed to Aryan instinct to validate Nazism. None of them have a rational case, and they admit it in the end. Their so-called case lies in the fact that they reject reason. On the other hand, capitalism does have a case: philosophical, ethical, historical, economic. The case rests on complex rational argumentation, on proving its superiority to all other systems by the use of facts and logic. Well, if reason is valid, capitalism is safe. If reason is invalid, then capitalism falls to the ground. The system then cannot stand and will be brushed aside. So this is your third issue. Capitalism depends on men's acceptance of reason. Now, these are the three basic issues on which capitalism depends. To sum up for you, if men accept man as an end in himself, this reality as what's real, and reason as man's means of knowledge, then capitalism, individual freedom, mutual human respect will develop almost automatically. But if men are against these big three, if they demand self-sacrifice and turn to another dimension and extol unreason in any form, then capitalism is impossible, and any remnants of it still left from earlier times will quickly vanish, even if people still want the remnants. No system, including capitalism, can withstand the opposite philosophic base. It can't withstand the constant pressure of an alien philosophy, trumpeted daily by all the leading intellectuals. Now, this is not just theory. It's how it actually worked out historically. The United States was founded on the philosophy of the Enlightenment, the philosophy of the 18th century. And its pillars, the Founding Fathers' philosophy, was the same three issues in essence. Reason, which they called intellect at the time. Reality, which they called nature. And selfishness, which they called the right to the pursuit of happiness. Now, they didn't hold these ideas consistently, unfortunately. They held many, many contradictions, and that's what finally defeated them. But predominantly at the time, those were their ideas. And on this basis, they proceeded to create the freest, the greatest, the most capitalistic country in history. The tragedy of the West is the fact that at the very same time, in the late 18th century, a philosophic counter-revolution was being set in motion. A revolution against the Enlightenment and against America. Its author was a German philosopher who was the exact opposite of the Founding Fathers on every essential question. I mean Immanuel Kant, who is the father of all subsequent philosophy, including communism and Nazism. On the three issues that we were looking at tonight, this morning, he preached more extreme negative views than were ever before preached in all of history. As an example, in ethics, he preached self-sacrifice as an end in itself. The medievals had said, if you sacrifice for God, it's all right for you to want a reward in heaven. If you give up everything for your neighbor, it's okay for you to get pleasure from watching your neighbor at least enjoy himself. Kant said, no, this is corrupt, this is selfish. If you're doing it to get to heaven or to get your kicks from watching your neighbor as pleasure, you're still selfish. You're still pursuing personal satisfaction. You have to give up all pleasure, including even the pleasure of being charitable. To be moral, said Kant, you must suffer for its own sake, without desire, without reward. You have to become an obedient zombie who selflessly does his duty. And this was the first consistent expression of the ethics of self-sacrifice, which swept the world thereafter. Now you might say, well, how can men live in this world by Kant's method? And that brings us to Kant's metaphysics. His attitude is, this world? What the hell is that? The medievals thought this world was at least partly real, even if heaven was above it. Kant said, this world is completely unreal. It's merely appearance. It's a collective delusion in the human mind. It's a figment of human consciousness, so it's not important. We don't even have to think about it. What counts, he said, is true reality, which, however, he added, is unknowable. Unknowable to our senses, to logic, to science, to reason. As to reason, the medievals had said, well, we can know something by reason, even if not the highest truths. Kant said, you can know nothing important by reason. Reason is limited to a world of superficial appearances. True reality, he said, can be approached only by ineffable mystic feeling. Now, Kant's are the ideas that have ruled all philosophy since his time. Those are the ideas that ruled the intellectuals in this country through the 19th century as they struggled to reverse what the Founding Fathers had created, and Kant is what rules our colleges still today. And here I speak from personal knowledge, having taught and lectured in American colleges east and west for many, many years. If you say to today's college professors, capitalism is practical, it leads to abundance, prosperity, and so on, so why don't you come out in favor of it? The answer you'll get in essence is, so what? It's immoral, it's selfish, it's evil. And besides that, it's low and vulgar and materialistic, and on top of that, I feel there's a better way. Now, some years ago, I heard of an incident which reveals accurately the college atmosphere of today. This was a conversation overheard in a university in Los Angeles, and I quote you, it was in print. student. In other words, what you're saying is that the only kind of productive economy is one controlled by the law of supply and demand and with profit as its goal. Instructor, that's right, laissez-faire capitalism. Student, and that's the only way for a country to be prosperous? Instructor, correct. Student, but isn't there some solution to this? Unquote. Now you see, this is a problem to him, and you need a solution to it, because he knows that capitalism is rotten. Therefore, if it works, he's got a problem, and we have to find some way to evade the evidence and get around it. Now, you can see from just this, you could not fight this mentality by telling him that capitalism is practical. You have to go much, much deeper than that. Now, this student happened to have a pro-capitalist instructor, which is rare. Our colleges today are the basic source of the anti-capitalist trend of the country. The colleges teach the Kantian philosophy to the school teachers, the media, the movie makers, the preachers, the psychologists, the stand-up comics, and finally to the politicians who hear it in classes when they're young, read it in the papers, listen to it on their analyst's couch, see it at the movies, and then merely continue to mouth it, to utter for the rest of their lives the things that they have always heard. This is why college students are so left politically, in contrast to blue-collar youth who don't go to college. It's because the college kids are steeped in a Kantian philosophy, whereas the less educated kids get less of it. They get some, to be sure, because it's everywhere today, but less. More of the original American tradition remains with them. And the same thing is true of the people more generally. They're better than the intellectual leadership because they're less educated, which is a virtue in this respect. They're less exposed to the corrupt influences in today's colleges. Well, what then is the solution? The battle lies in the universities, especially in the philosophy departments. You know, if you have any interest in the future and any influence, that's the spot I would pick to start. I suggest, if you're unfamiliar, study philosophy if you're interested. Come to your own conclusions on the main issues, investigate, use your own judgment, and then go out and take a look at what is being taught in the philosophy departments of our colleges. I think you will be amazed and aghast at how slanted, at how one-sided it is. And then if you have any influence, I suggest you start demanding some new viewpoints, some non-Kantian ideas be given a hearing. You don't have to demand equal time for pro-capitalist professors. A 1-to-10 ratio would be ample because capitalism is so much better. But today we don't get a 1-to-10 ratio. We don't even get a 1-to-100 ratio. Now, of course, other forms of action, economic and political, are important. Given our deteriorating scene today, it's desirable to take immediate action to combat disaster in whatever way you can. If you were confronted with the dike springing holes all around you, you still have to plug up the holes however you can. But I suggest to you that there's an inherent limit on what can be accomplished by this method. In other words, on the purely political or economic level. Even if there were a perfect candidate for president, and I hasten to add parenthetically that Ronald Reagan is not one, in my opinion. But even if there were a perfect pro-capitalist candidate, he could not do much, even if he were elected, so long as the intellectual philosophic atmosphere remains unchanged. Because at the first crisis of the mixed economy system after he took office, for instance, the pressure groups affected would scream in pain, and he would be virtually forced to concede some new favors or cushion to them, which sets off counterbalancing demands from other groups for new favors, new crises, and away we go. And if the president did try to cut back on the controls, the intellectuals, the other politicians, the professors, the newspapers would scream that he's giving in to big business, he's the servant of greed, you know the whole line, and he ends up essentially blocked and helpless. And this is why even the better figures in politics, like President Ford, for instance, could really do nothing during their term in office except maintain the status quo with a few fewer crises. What's necessary and what no politician by himself can do is to scrap the welfare state and institute capitalism. And this can't be done except by philosophical means, by having the colleges teach a philosophy of reason. In other words, it's fine to plug the holes up in the dike, but it's also a good idea to consider where the flood is coming from. It's the philosophy departments who are causing it and who must be tackled if the United States is to have a chance. Now, I don't believe in historical determinism. In other words, I don't believe that history is preordained, that doom is inevitable, and that we may as well just lie down and wait for it to happen. Men have free will. I think there is still time. I think there is still hope. But events are moving very rapidly, and how much time we have, I don't know. You know that I'm completing a book now, The Ominous Parallels, which studies the relationship, the similarities between America today and the Weimar Republic, Germany before Hitler. And I found that the basic philosophy of the two countries is Kantian, and as a consequence, the same existential cultural trends permeate both. The same in the arts, in the theater, in literature, in education, in the universities, in science, in religion, in the political parties, in economics. All of which I discuss. In economics, the salient features of the Weimar Republic was an advanced mixed economy, escalating controls, mounting pressure group warfare, the lurch from crisis to crisis, and in 1923, a runaway inflation. Hitler took power 10 years later. Now America is better. It's got a better past, and it's a much better country than Germany was. But cause and effect still operates. The same cause leads to the same effect in the end, unless the cause is removed. What capitalism needs now is not merely supporters, but ethical, metaphysical, epistemological supporters. In other words, men who will be its friends intellectually, men who will make themselves heard on the basic issues of our time. The price of liberty today is not merely vigilance, but philosophical vigilance. That's the battle that objectivism is fighting, and that's the kind of battle I should like to recommend to you this morning. Your help is sorely needed. Thank you very much.
Dr. Peacock will be willing to answer questions now. You may either raise your hand, and or otherwise, if you'd like to write out a question, someone will come along the aisles and pick them up or whatever. Thank you. And okay. Dr. Peacock, would you like to choose the...
Oh, yes, are there hands up? Mm-hmm. You have to wave because I only see motion. Yes, in the back. Yes, you. Should I repeat that? Or can
yeah, go ahead.
Why, if capitalism was such a resounding success in the 18th century, did people turn their backs on it? People didn't. Philosophers did. Philosophers are people, but they're a very special breed of people, and they were ruled entirely by Immanuel Kant. He was the decisive turning point influence. He took all the essential ideas of all the worst philosophers before him and made a monolithic system out of it, of a kind that had been unprecedented before. If there was someone at that time who had been able to answer him in kind, he would not have won the intellectual battle. I don't believe mankind is inherently irrational. There was no one. It was like the situation like you have today in politics, you had then in philosophy. In other words, you had a militant left and a frightened right, and the right kept appeasing the left. That's what happens in politics today. And at the time, you had militant Kantians and a kind of half-hearted, frightened Aristotelians who had forgotten most of Aristotle, and therefore they left him a free run, and he took over. Now, it took a long time. Kant still hasn't won by virtue of the state of this country today. The people are still largely on an Enlightenment basis. But he took over the intellectuals, and unfortunately, as I argued, it's the intellectuals who determine the course of history, not the people. There was someone... Yes, you. Do I believe in a superior being and life after death? No to either question. Only reality, only this reality. I would believe those things only if there were evidence, only if there was reason. And in all the studies I've given, The whole issue is those views are completely indefensible, and in fact, every argument is against. How did we come about? Well, you're asking me a biological or a cosmological question, so I could take it either way. A biological question, you don't need me to answer the processes of reproduction and so on. But if you ask more broadly, how did the Earth and so on come into existence? I take this view, what's called the primacy of existence. You have to start somewhere. You cannot have an infinite regress of explanations. I start with the universe that I know exists, namely the physical world, including the Earth and the stars. Now, there are many permutations and combinations and changes within it. But the basic reality, you must begin somewhere. Suppose you say, well, no, we can't take the physical world as a primary. It must have had a creator. Nothing can always exist. So let's say it's God that created it. Then you're immediately confronted with the question, well, what created God? And you either have an infinite regress of a second and a third and so on, or you say at some point, well, after all, you have to start somewhere. Something just existed by its nature, and I agree. You have to start somewhere. What do you gain by inventing a fantasy and then stopping there? You may as well start with what you know exists. That's a brief answer, not to make this into a polemic against God. Yes. Right. Well, you're asking me for strategy of argumentation, which is a very difficult thing. The gentleman is saying that he agrees that the colleges today are Kantian, but if you confront Kantian professors with the fact that they're Kantian, they'll deny it. And how do you force them to admit their actual sources? It's a very difficult and unrewarding attempt to do it, because part of their whole method is to deny that they have any fundamental views and to just take their feelings as self-evident. And therefore, they're not concerned with historical antecedents, and they're eager to show that they're the latest word, not that they are a continuation of the Oriental viewpoint of 2,500 years ago. So the most you can do is try to focus on one or two things and try and show them, if you had one that you can talk to, on ethics or on epistemology, ask him, do you believe you can know physical reality objectively by the use of the human mind? And if you get him to say yes, you have a potential convert. And if you get him to say no, you say, well, then you're a Kantian, you see. So you have some angle, but that really won't work, because these people are trained, they have PhDs, they've got the deepest, extensive brainwashing on how to disguise anything. And consequently, they'll have a comeback, if they leaped out of a skyscraper window, they would be arguing that the pavement doesn't exist when they're this far from it, you know. So you won't do too well. Yes, in the stripes. Right. Well, that's a big difference, yeah. Well, I'll answer that question. Could you start? Yeah. I think I understand your question. The question, in effect, amounts to, could you short-circuit the historical process or assist it, speed it up, by fielding political candidates who would educate the country on the issues that are important, rather than trying to do it only or primarily through the philosophy department? No, I would say you absolutely cannot do that, for a number of reasons, to indicate to you briefly. What is required is philosophic education, not political education. The country is already conservative. You do not have to educate them, essentially, if you follow the tenor of my talk, in the value of freedom, but on the fundamental issues on which that depends. And that is not possible in a election campaign, presidential or any other. An election campaign has to be, in essence, geared to politics and usually to very concrete issues. What's your stand on Afghanistan and Iran and ERA and a whole bunch of things of that order? You can't start on that level and say, by the way, on the side, I believe in this reality and reason, that we haven't time to discuss that now. That is out of the question. It can't be done. But secondly, if it could be done, the last group that would be able to do it, or that I would have anything to do with, is a libertarian group. And I'll tell you very simply what my primary objection is to any libertarian group. And that is, it's fundamentally non-philosophical character. Libertarianism in general, or in the particular form of the political party, is an attempt at a united front. United front means, let's ignore fundamental differences, let's ignore fundamental questions, let's come together on the one thing we can agree on and go to the country with that regardless of what it depends on. And that's why they even call it libertarianism, because they think liberty is safe. Let's call it libertarianism, and then, doesn't make any difference. You get it from God, Mr. Buckley, you're with us. You can be with us. And you get it from the New Left, from a drug trance, Mr. Hippie, you can be with us. And you are an anarchist, and you don't believe in government at all, Mr. So-and-so, wouldn't even dignify with names, you can be with us. We'll all go together, and we'll say, to hell with basic issues, we're just for liberty. Now, I say that as a fundamentally misguided attempt, because the whole issue rests on the foundation. I would much rather go to the country with a group who believed in reason and reality and selfishness and differed on everything politically than the reverse, because then the fundamentals would set their own terms and the most consistent one, the pro-capitalist, would have no trouble in winning. But to go with a hodgepodge on one thing like that, like liberty, is ridiculous. You cannot even define what liberty is without a fundamental philosophy. There's no use stealing, as most libertarians do, Ayn Rand's definition of liberty and saying we know what it is at the absence of physical force, because any opponent will wipe you out in 2 minutes if you don't have the foundation to be able to defend it. More than that, I think that libertarianism has actually badly hurt capitalism. I know myself, in going around the country, there's a great many very respectable, reputable groups who think if this kind of crackpot, anarchist, affiliation with the New Left, some of whom are friendly to Red China and God knows what else they advocate, is the advocates of capitalism, then the capitalist side must be even worse than we thought. And you have to go to great pains to try and say, distinguish the system from its latest maniacal advocates. And from that point of view, I brush libertarians out of my hair. I don't have anything to do with them. I think they harm the cause for capitalism. I wouldn't vote for them. That makes it my viewpoint clear, I think, on that question.
Excuse me, Dr. Peikoff, excuse me a second.
Yes.
I would like to request that the people that ask their questions do step up to one of the microphones in asking the question, because it is difficult for the people in back to hear their question, and I would enjoy that.
I thought I had repeated it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes,
I have a couple written ones here, too.
What? A question concerning the aspects of capitalism as the rights of the individual versus the rights of the group, and it seems to be getting more that we're getting the rights of the group over the rights of the individual. And did it start with the corporate enterprise versus the small businessman who just kept stepping up and up and up? And why?
No, it did not. I don't have to repeat that. It did not start with the corporate enterprise. It started with philosophy. Actually, the first philosopher in the modern world to take that view was a German follower of Kant named Fichte, who came out for collectivism overtly with the idea, this is right at the turn of the 19th century, who began in the modern world the idea that the group is supreme above the individual and the individual is just a fragment of the group. That was then taken over by Hegel. Now, you have Professor Hessen, I believe he's here in the audience today, but he will be speaking, a couple of nights from now, and he has written a book on the corporation, which I recommend to you, because he points out very clearly and documents in that book that the essence of a corporation is an association of individuals, sovereign, autonomous individuals, by their voluntary agreement to achieve certain limited business ends. There's nothing collectivistic about people cooperating. As long as it's voluntary and each individual does it freely on his own judgment, we are a group here, but that doesn't make us a collective. When would it be a collective? We're still individuals here, and presumably still individualistic. When would we become a collective? If Jane held a gun on us and said, the seminar is above its members. You all have to live to serve and sacrifice it, and I appoint myself representative of the group. That would then be a collective estate that we'd have here, but it wouldn't be the fact that we assembled together by voluntary means. It would be the fact that someone wants to use force to make us enact the ethics of self-sacrifice. Now, you can't therefore blame corporations, and it's not true even economically that big corporations cause any trouble to small ones. If the small one has something to offer, the small businessmen, they have existed side by side with large corporations and still do. So it's a myth, but I'd like to leave it to the economist. If you want to ask either Professor Hessen or Professor Reisman, what are the chances of small business and in a capitalist society, ask them that, because they'll give you chapter and verse more detail. I'd like to stay more on the philosophic side. But you can't explain philosophic trends on that kind of level, because the question is why didn't people see the obvious fact that there were flourishing individual entrepreneurs even today in the midst of the big corporations, which today have a very big advantage because they're entrenched by government subsidies, by government protection, tariff protection, by income tax. You know, and the income tax is one of the worst measures for entrenching today's corporations, because no small businessman can get enough capital amassed to invest a competing enterprise. Now, in capitalism, you don't have that system. Have a big corporation does not have the ability to hold the market by sheer productive power, it's out. And the same is true of heirs. You know, the expression used to be common in this country at the turn of the century was from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. It was so common a phenomenon. In other words, if you were poor and you became rich by your own effort, you couldn't pass on your wealth in perpetuity and become, you know, governor of New York State or a president of the country. Your grandchild was back to shirt sleeves. He was back to poverty again if he couldn't live up to your productive prowess. Now there is no threat to any man of ability, and corporations are no problem. Now, here's a written question. Well, I'll do it briefly. Is it possible for a capitalist, by your definition, to have a conscience? Absolutely. But a conscience means, I take it, that you mean a sense of right and wrong. And I tried to indicate to you what the sense of right and wrong would be. It would have to be an ethics of rational self-interest. His conscience would say to him, be honest, be productive, be rational, be independent, be self-sustaining, have integrity, be just in your dealings with others, have pride with yourself. In yourself, that would give you some of the virtues. If you want more detail, I suggest you read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and you'll get a detailed account of what a capitalist conscience would be. But don't use the term conscience as synonymous with a religious morality. It simply means a sense of right and wrong, and that leaves open the question, what is right and wrong? And you know my view on that. Then the written question goes on, the same question. If the rich and intelligent don't give to the poor and needy, who will? The answer is very simple. In essence, if the intelligent were left free, the poor wouldn't be so needy. Where does the wealth come from? It comes from someone's mind, someone's intelligence. Why are so many people so poor in the world, and even to some extent in this country? Because intelligence is hampered, shackled. You have to be virtually a contortionist even to keep your business afloat today. Given what's going on in Washington, and there's no incentive, more and more people are withdrawing, giving up, or they're completely caught in a bureaucratic maze. If you're concerned with the poor, then the most crucial thing is get out of the way of the able. Let them function, let them produce, and the result will be a chronic rise in the standard of living for everybody. Even what we call poor in this country, and even in today's mixed economy system, are overflowing with abundance compared to the state of the rest of the world. I mean, you can't take the propaganda about the poor at its face value. The liberals have a vested interest in saying everybody is starving so we can have more government. But that is ridiculous. You know that in World War II, the Russians thought that they would make propaganda capital out of the grapes of wrath. You know that novel about the Okies in the Depression?
And they imported into Russia with a big fanfare about the final revelation of how awful the capitalist system is. And they had to withdraw it after the initial showing. They canceled the run because it was causing discontent among the populace on the grounds that the Okies had shoes. Now, if you're concerned with the poor and the needy, get the government out of the path. Now, if no one does help the poor and needy, won't we all be parties to mass genocide? Well, you have a very low opinion of mankind. I don't share it. I think the overwhelming majority of people are decent, honest, capable of self-support. There is a certain marginal element that is not capable of self-support, either through inherited disease or accident or, you know, something of that kind. That has to be a marginal element, because if it was characteristic of the species as such, obviously we couldn't survive. Man would then be a being incapable of living. There is a marginal element in trouble through no fault of its own. In such a case, the only proper outlet is private charity. An objectivist doesn't object to private charity under certain conditions. If the person is truly deserving, he's not in trouble through any fault of his own. If there's no sacrifice involved, if you do it out of your surplus, and you don't do it as a sacrifice, and if you above all remember you do not get any moral credit for it. According to objectivism, you get moral credit for achievement, not for giving away what you've achieved. You get moral credit for thought, effort, action, production, not for charity. Charity is an entirely marginal issue. You can give to people if you think they deserve it on your own, but it's a marginal problem. And in a free country, never was a problem. Do you know that if farmers had a fire in the 19th century, it became a legend that they were richer after the fire than before, because the neighbors from all over inundated them with help in that kind of disaster. There was a great deal of benevolent goodwill among people because they were free. Nobody was a threat to anybody else. They didn't all have citizens' lobbies in Washington trying to extract their neighbors' farms, which they do today. And the result today is if a farmer's crops burn down, he's lucky not to be lynched at the same time by his neighbors who are trying to get, see him as, you know, the enemy. But it didn't used to be that way. So don't project the conditions of mutual hostility and indifference that pertain today to a free country, and people are taxed as they are today. I wouldn't give a penny to anything. I don't blame people for saying to hell with it all. So I can't answer.
Are there any other questions?
The lady? Yes.
Would you elaborate on your
Would I elaborate on my views on Reagan? Needless to say, I'm not an advocate of Carter or Anderson. So that is not the alternative. In essence, Reagan ties his advocacy of capitalism to religion. And for the reasons that I gave in the talk today, I believe that any such attempt is very, very harmful to the long-range prospects of capitalism in this country. I believe the crucial thing is the philosophic base. Now all the conservatives always give a certain lip service to God, but there are certain issues which become revealing as to whether it's more than a lip service and whether it means something or not. And the decisive test in this issue, I think, is a candidate's stand on abortion. Now, Reagan has come out very strongly against abortion. And I believe that any such candidate is immediately disqualified as an advocate of individual rights. Abortion is not anti-life. The fetus is not a human being, merely a potential human being, merely a mass of material that can become animate and human, but is not. It has no rights. Rights begins where a separate, viable human existence begins. To tell a pregnant woman who does not want a child that she must have it is to tell her she has no right to live her life. To tell her, you have to sacrifice your desires, your happiness, because remember, raising a child is not a parenthetical or peripheral issue, not if you do it rationally. It's a lifetime, or at least decades-long enlistment of effort, energy, attention. It takes over your life. It's like the equivalent of your career. If you want it, that's fine. If you don't, to have somebody say to you, you are obligated to do it and sacrifice your life in the name of this mass of tissue, which is not even an entity yet, is truly monstrous in my opinion. And it means that this kind of candidate cannot pose as a champion of individual rights. What it means is the typical combination of religion with some remnants of capitalism. And that is what has ruined the country, and that will continue to ruin it if someone like that gets in. Now, there are many other things about Reagan that I could say beyond this. But, for instance, I heard the other day that he made a speech to the effect that in order to save the economy from the demands of labor, we should have as a solution to bring labor unions under the antitrust laws. Now, I can't think of a more catastrophic policy than that. I'm an advocate of capitalism. My idea of getting to capitalism is removing people from the power of the government, not expanding. If governments are business is being strangled by the antitrust laws, then repeal the antitrust laws. But Reagan's idea of making it fair, and this is not original with him, is to bring organized labor under the antitrust also. Now, organized labor is the last large economic group in this country. Labor said, this is an outrage. We have a right to free bargaining. We're American citizens, and the government can't tell us what to do. That is what has staved off total dictatorship in this country. Now, I'm not obviously a labor union radical. I don't believe there should be compulsory unions, but I say as an actual fact, labor is the last large group saving this country from complete collapse. For an advocate of capitalism to suggest that it be brought under the antitrust laws and turned into, therefore, the kind of abject cowards that businessmen are. You know what the antitrust laws are. Anybody is guilty as soon as they breathe for whatever they do because they did it. Anybody can be interpreted as having committed any crime as prices are too low, too high, or the same as everybody else's. It's a crime on all three fronts. And therefore, it's simply a matter of waiting to be singled out and under the threat of treble damages. That effectively removes that element from ideological contention. They're then paralyzed, and they just sit in the wings and wait for the axe to fall. That is what has happened to big business. To suggest that that should be done to labor also is really a disaster. Now, I take just those two issues. I could multiply it endlessly. I think Reagan has many good positions on many individual points, but would be a disaster ideologically and philosophically. He would not do any more than he did in California, precisely because he has no philosophic base, which means he might slow up a few programs, but then he'd expand a few programs, and the inflation would catch him, or the depression would catch him. You already saw when he appointed Mr. Schweiker as his running mate how firm he is on his commitment. He's a kind of, I would call him a religious hyphen conservative hyphen religionist, pragmatist. And that is a very unappetizing, frightening combination. What I'd be most afraid of is if he would get in, some crisis like a runaway inflation would take place, which seems to be in the offing. I don't know, I can't predict when, but not in the very distant future. And then the country would say, capitalism caused it. We had a capitalist president or pro-free enterprise president, and it'll be the 29 Depression over again. Now, I went through I don't know how many decades where as soon as you uttered the word capitalism, you had to stand on your head and give a speech on why it didn't cause the 29 Depression. Except Hoover was much more damaging to this country than Roosevelt was. And the same thing would happen again. I'm afraid to think how badly the country would be set back ideologically if Reagan got in. And the one thing only that I would say in order to be fair is that in terms of foreign policy, we're in a very ominous state right now with the Russian expansionism and the systematic dismantling of this country's military defenses. And that is a major issue. If I thought that Reagan would do something about that, I would consider that a relevant factor, since Carter and Anderson obviously won't. But I don't know that he will, and I don't know what would ever convince me that he would. So at this time, I would simply abstain from any vote as a protest. I'll try to get the gentleman at the very back. Yes.
Thanks. Essentially, I have an epistemological question for you. In your discussion, however, I sometimes wonder where is man only a mind? The emotions and the will of man in history have often carried the day in major upheavals, which were all for the good so often. However, I want to ask the question...
Well, I'd like to comment on that, but go ahead. All right, I'll make
Also, well, here's another one. You mentioned wealth is only from the intelligent. I've seen some pretty dumb people who can really make money. And then, lastly...
You're giving me a running agenda here. We only have a few minutes. Okay.
Okay. Where do we get the idea of even G-O-D? If we only have a reason as a dependable authority, where do we get the idea of G-O-D? As a theist, it is difficult for me to realize how, with only a mind as a dependable source, I could get at least an adequate or acceptable idea about which to talk of, let alone whether to worship.
Okay, I get it. The objectivist view is that emotions are consequences of conclusions, of your intellectual conclusions, of your ideas, above all of your value judgments. I can't prove this to you at this moment simply for lack of time, but in essence, objectivism denies that emotions are inherent primaries or that they're caused by physical or mystical means. We say that you hold certain ideas and above all certain value judgments, and that's what leads you to respond a certain way. As a very simple example, a young baby, if you hold a gun before his head, will not respond with fear. He doesn't know what it is. Even a man who knows what it is, but wants to die, is suicidal, has given up life, will not respond with terror. He may even respond with pleasure. When would a person respond with fear as a simple emotion? If he knows what it is and that it represents a threat to something that matters to him. In this sense, emotions are entirely an intellectual issue, although most people don't know their value judgments or ideas, and therefore they experience their emotions as inexplicable primaries. Therefore, I say emotions are not primary factors, they're consequences of past thinking, whether known or not. If men act on emotions without knowing their sources, and those emotions are in fact counter to reason, the consequences are going to be disaster, because it means they're abandoning their mind, which is their means of survival. You claim good historical examples. The historical examples I'll give you are United States, where enthusiasm, you know, that was the term they used in the 18th century, it was the cardinal vice when this country was formed. Enthusiasm meant rampant emotionalism, following your emotion without going intellectually. And that was regarded as the cardinal sin, which is the objectivism holds that it is, that led to this country. On the other hand, an advocate of unrestrained emotion and so-called will was, even the word will, was Adolf Hitler, who preached Aryan instinct, the Aryan will, and so on, and you see where his passions led him. So if on that point, I entirely disagree. Now you say dumb people have made money, sure. Particularly in the mixed economy system. They have a terrific way of making money today because it does not take basic intelligence to make government contacts. It simply means you have to know how to give parties, bribe, and be one of the boys. But remember, we are talking about scavengers on a system of wealth already created. If the Puritans and the equivalent came to these shores and decided to be dumb, not to think and not to function, where would they get the handouts from? What good would their dumbness do them? There would be no wealth. They would just simply sit there and starve, or they'd be like the primitives who just, you know, roam around nomadically. Before a dumb person can take advantage of the system, there has to be all the brains that created the wealth. Now, even under capitalism, there would be luck. There would be dumb people occasionally who would put their money on a certain stock on somebody's tip, and by luck they made money. Good luck to them. It's not stolen from anybody. It's a completely marginal element. I'm not saying everybody who makes a nickel necessarily did it through brilliance. I'm saying the basic issue of wealth is a matter of intelligence, and in the long run, even in any individual life in the long run, because if the guy is dumb, when he collects money from the first stock, the next thing he does is buy the Brooklyn Bridge. So it ends up in the hands of somebody who does have brains, if you have a free country. Now you ask, finally, where did the idea of God come from if we only had reason? God is a mixture of concepts. A mystical mixture, but nevertheless a mixture. And concepts is the essence of the human faculty of reason. A concept we form by observing certain facts of reality through our senses and then abstracting common denominators. There's nothing mystical about that, and man has the power of imagination. He has the power of taking concepts which he can form from experience and then combine them in ways that have no actual counterpart. There's nothing mystical about that. I can say half man and half horse, centaur. I can form a concept without perceiving one by perceiving men and horses. And then just in my private fantasy, a la Walt Disney, the make-up centaur. And I can do exactly the same thing for power, which is a natural concept, knowledge, virtue, you name it, and then stick them all together and say infinity, totality of all of it, and call it God. That doesn't mean there is a referent for such a concept, nor is there anything mystical to get its elements. The mystical part comes in thinking that because you can think of it, therefore it must exist. By that same reason, you'd have to say there was a Santa Claus. Yes. You're watching the time, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll be briefer if you ask one part instead of three-part questions, okay?
I know, it's the one-part question. What do you think of preserving natural beauty and natural resources for future generations, to whom this will also, the physical world will also be the total reality?
Nothing of it. I'm opposed to the ecological movement. I think that that is the conservation movement, the preservation movement, the, all that back to nature movement. I don't believe there's any scientific basis for it, and I do not believe that the unrestrained capitalist exploitation of natural resources will limit them in any way whatever. In fact, they will simply expand them. They'll expand them in exactly the same way in which we have more natural resources now than the primitives who lived in this country, the Indians, could even have imagined in the 18th century. That is, after two centuries of exploitation. The essence of capitalism is the discovery of new materials, new fuels, new sources of energy, new machinery, new ways of exploiting the resources. You're never going to run out of them. Now, Professor Reisman, in his book on price controls, The Government Against the Economy, makes a really marvelous point here to the effect that the entire earth is one solidly packed ball of natural resources from the center right up. And we've come down, I don't know how many feet or miles, but there's you couldn't even begin to start inventorying it, let alone using it, with the advanced technology that unfettered capitalism would make available. Now, this idea that we're running out of everything and we're going to starve, and therefore let's economize and preserve and save for the future generations, is simply an anti-capitalist, anti-industry ploy that is the latest in a whole bunch of rationalizations put forth by statists in order to hobble business. Now, as to beauty, you said preserve natural beauty. You have to make a basic decision, a basic fact. Either you're the only one that likes an unspoiled park, or there are others. If there are others, enough to make it commercially viable, believe me, capitalists will provide it. They want to make money. And if they did, if you've ever seen the condition of Central Park, which is naturally preserved beauty in New York, you couldn't wait to turn that over to an entrepreneur so you could walk into it. Anything that people want becomes commercially viable if enough of them want it and are prepared to pay for it. We're not getting our present park system free, if you know what the budget of the Interior Department is. And these things are costing a fortune, and the public has prohibited access to them because they don't want people to spoil nature. It's an end in itself only for the bureaucrats to write forms about and regulate. I reject it entirely. Conservation, natural beauty, ecology, that all of that is in my opinion, is lower than the 29 Depression as an argument against capitalism. Should this be the last one? Would you discuss the increasing rate of violent crime? The relationship between the assault against people and property and the prevailing philosophic influences. Is there an identifiable cause and effect? Well, I don't think it's so broad as that kids are taught unreason in the schools and then they go out and commit crimes. It's not that direct a causal relationship. What I think is the causal relationship is through certain economic and social intermediaries. First, people are taught unreason. Then the system becomes rigidified, the economic system, so that in fact, there is very little opportunity for many people today, given the great number of government controls. Little opportunity to rise, much less chance for upward mobility, much less chance for success than they once had. They're given government schooling, which is, you know, the last thing anybody could need, and which ends up paralyzing them intellectually. They're prepared for nothing, and then they're turned loose and they feel very bitter. I sympathize with those people, with the poor who are bitter, because they've been given a very, very bad time. They've been taught to blame it on capitalism and the rich instead of blaming it on the kind of ideas which led to this frozen, mixed economy. They've been inculcated with bitterness by the liberals. They're told the world owes you a living, but the evil rich aren't coming forth with it. And the result is they rush out to commit crimes. Now, the cause there is what the ideas that were taught to these kids and that permitted the system to freeze and solidify the way it did, to close off opportunity. Then there's the phenomenon of middle-class crime, affluent youth and their crimes, which they commit on drugs. The single largest cause of violent crime in New York, in any event, is drug use. And drug use is exclusively a philosophic phenomenon. You never had that, even when I was going to school, which is not that, but still this century. I remember it was a scandal, I think it was Robert Mitchum, somebody was arrested for the use of marijuana when I was in school, and that was considered such a scandal at the time, I can't remember my mother letting me go to see his movies anymore. Now you know what the situation is today. Now what is the cause of that kind of change? These kids are taught, these are now college youth, essentially, and then they filter down to the high schools, they're taught. You can't make sense of anything, reason is evil, but there's another world. Mind is evil, you have to try to stifle it, you have to go by your emotions, which is all that counts, you have to merge into the group, there is no future, doom is the only thing to expect, there's going to be war, there's going to be collapse, the evil people, the capitalists are in charge, tune in, drop out, tune out, you know, the whole litany, and in the kind of despair that is the net product of that kind of ideological training, the kids turn to drugs, and that leads to crime. So I would say fundamentally, the violent increase in crime is a result partly of the brainwashing of the affluent college kids and the drug addiction to which it leads, and partly the bitterness of the urban groups that are frozen by a mixed economy and are told that it's the fault of the exploiters and don't know what the issues are. But indirectly, it is all a consequence of philosophy, and it won't be counteracted except by a change in philosophy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peacock.
Thank you.